to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. Each weekday morning here on the Genesis Communication Network, we strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths that are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to help you understand what is occurring behind these headlines. Now, typically in our second hour, we engage God on His terms, but this is IQ Friday. We will have IQ Al-Rasuli with us in the second hour, so we're going to invert the normal order of the show. And this morning, during our first hour, we're going to return to Yahweh's presentation of His creation of the universe, and today we will commence for the first time in that process speaking about the genesis of life. Ultimately, we do this because there is only one covenant and only one path to it. The presentation of the Torah, covenant presentation, is the one and only means to participate in a relationship with God. And so we will return our focus to His witness. During the next 2 hours, if you'd like to question or affirm anything I or IQ Al-Rasuli has to say, our number is 877-300-7645. As another program note, on Monday morning, during the first hour of the show, we're going to have a guest who is a brilliant researcher. He has written a series of articles that caught my eye on the role of the Helsinki, the Stockholm Syndrome, if you will, in development of Islam. And it's some of the best researched, most rationally presented evidence that I've read in a long time. So I asked the author of these articles to be on our show, and he's agreed to do so, and that'll be on Monday morning. Now, returning to the presentation in the Bereshit, which is the opening book of Yahweh's Torah, which means teaching and not law, we have come to the point that our solar system has now been formed. Our planet has had time to cool. The earth was now ready for the gathering of liquid water into oceans, the cradle of life. Using the formula we were given, we can conclude that the third cosmological day dawned sometime around 3.8 billion years ago. This corresponds to the time the fossil record tells us that plants first flourished on our planets, in our planet's emerging seas. This is God's statement, one of two, regarding this process. He is now telling us that what He witnessed was the natural outgrowth of what He had put into motion on day one. The Almighty said, "Let the waters, by way of separation in the orderly sequence of exchanging one thing for another, under the abode of the stars, lay in wait, collected and bound together into one place, and let that which is parched and lifeless, the Yabasha, appear." And it existed, correct and verifiable. And God called that which was dry and lifeless the Yabasha, land. And the gathering and binding together of the waters He called seas. And God saw and considered that it was good, that it was appropriate, pleasant, agreeable, excellent, and beneficial. During our program yesterday, we examined the meaning of Yabasha, which is why I went ahead and translated it for you today, parched and lifeless. We learned its meaning by examining a statement that appeared in the prophet Yahusha, the prophet Yashayahu, I should say. Yashayahu is the correct name for Isaiah, and there God told us that Jacob, which is a synonym for Yisrael, had become dry and parched, lacking the living waters that are provided by the set-apart spirit. And so that on the last day of the tribulation, that I should probably even say more correctly, on the day that He returns at the end of the tribulation. The tribulation will continue for 5 days after this point. But that at that time, that his spirit will be poured out on those who are lifeless and parched. And so we now have an understanding of the meaning of this unique word. And that is has value to us because Yabesha not only defines souls who are bereft of Yahweh's living waters as provided by the set-apart spirit. And that provides, of course, a redemptive overtone to this proclamation. Scientifically, it is a fact that life was conceived in the seas and that that the bloom of life, which ultimately came out of the seas, emerged from the seas, seeded the parched and lifeless land, causing it to live and grow. As a matter of fact, it was the condensation of water from the seas that would irrigate the land itself. So God is going to speak next about the life that came to exist on the land, but he wants you to know scientifically that life emerged in the seas because the land was initially lifeless. The spiritual insight is further evidenced in this Torah passage by the word for gathering. It was ka'ah, which means to provide hope, to look forward with confidence to that which is good and beneficial, anticipating the future event with eager expectation. And here, while the land was dry and parched, the seas having been gathered into one place, and they being the seed of life, there was, in fact, an eager expectation that something beneficial, something very good, would soon occur. Even the word for place, when God said that he gathered the seas into to one place, is synonymous with the concept that underlies salvation. It was from Makum. Makum speaks of the standing place where one lives. It is therefore analogous of the upright pole on Mount Moriah that facilitated Passover and became the doorway to heaven. It based upon kum, which means to stand, the concept here is that God stood up for us so that we could stand with him. For those who have gone to a camp or have been part of a program where they sung the song Kumbaya, Kumbaya means stand with Yah. And that is God's concept. He stood up for us so we could stand with him. That's why bowing down in a religious ceremony is so offensive to him, because it inverts his plan. It negates everything that he is attempting to do. That would be like a father kneeling down to lift up their child, and rather than their child grasping the father's hand and rising, standing next to the father, the child instead prostrating themselves on the floor. It would be an inversion of the intended purpose. Further, the word for appear in this passage has redemption written all over it as well. Ra'ah means to show oneself, become visible by way of illumination, to find delight through revelation, to be considered and provided for, aided and supported, selected so as to be present with, to meet and experience. Ra'ah is the word for see, and it conveys the concept of perspective, which God is now providing us with. He is providing us with a perspective of the creation of the universe, telling us three stories in one, that of future human history, that of the creative process itself, so that we know who he is and what he has done, but also the plan of reconciliation and redemption that he is embedding into this story, provides us the same perspective that we will need to reconcile our relationship with him, to enter into a relationship with him. And what we find is the same 6+1 pattern that is engraved into the creation account is the same pattern that he uses in the 7 Moed Mikre, the 7 meetings with God, whereby we are called out of this world so that we can be welcomed into God's presence. Now, since Yah could have chosen considerably more mundane terms in the presentation of the beginning of the third day, the third creative epoch, but he didn't, it's incumbent upon us to explore the reasons for the salvation references within the Bereshith timeline. Now, personally, I think the answer is obvious. There are three accounts embedded in this Genesis witness. This is the story of creation, of salvation, and of human history. As such, the 6+1 pattern presented in Bereshith and reaffirmed countless other places serves as the foundation of Yahweh's prophetic timeline, especially as it relates to the fall and ultimate redemption of humankind. As a matter of fact, the passage that we went to learn the definition of Yabasha speaks of the ultimate reconciliation of Yisrael to Yahweh. It is the culminating event of the first 6,000 years of human history. So before we return to Yah's narrative and creative testimony and decipher the events depicted on the second half of the third day, it would be remiss of us if we did not complete Yahweh's prophetic announcement in Yashayah, which is Isaiah, where we are told that the Spirit, remember from yesterday, he said that the Spirit would be poured out upon a parched and lifeless Jacob. Now, Jacob is a synonym for Yisrael. Because of the covenant, Jacob became Yisrael. So after saying that his Spirit would be poured out on a parched and lifeless Yisrael, parched and lifeless because they had abandoned the covenant, they had abandoned God, that in the last day, they changed their direction, they changed their attitude. And this is a verification. This is now future history as well. This one will say, speaking of Yisrael, I am Yahweh's. And another will write on his hand the name Yahweh, calling me by name. Thus says Yahweh, ruler of Yisrael and Yisrael's Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts. I am the first, I am the last. There is no God besides me. Would you write Yahweh's name on your hand? Do you say, I am Yahweh's? Do you know that Yahweh is your Redeemer? These folks will.
Water.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're examining what occurred during the third creative day from Yahweh's testimony, having reviewed what God said about the first half of the third creative day. We know that that land and sea became separate. Dry land, for the first time, was visible on the planet. The seas were gathered, and so we had the opportunity for the cradle of life. God said initially that that the land was desolate. That means lifeless. But now he is telling us that the land will sprout forth. He says, and God said, let the land sprout vegetation, dasha dashe, shoot forth greenery, become verdant, growing plant life, be productive, live, grow green. Plants reproducing, this is Eseb, Zera, yielding an extended family, conceiving offspring, being reborn and renew, in successive generations, Pare, as first fruits, producing offspring by way of a harvest. Trees producing offspring after their kind. Kind is from Min, class and species, whose offspring, Zera, are upon the earth, that would be upon the land, existing upright and established, Hayaken. So, we have God saying that he wanted the land to sprout vegetation. This is dasha. Dasha is to shoot forth that which is green, become verdant, to grow plant life. Plant is from Eseb, and the term for reproducing is zera, which is a the concept of seed, of conceiving and life in successive generations. Trees reproducing offspring after their kind, whose seed, zera, are upon the earth, are upon the land, existing upright and established. Now, it's interesting that in this Bereshith 1:11 passage, Deshen, a derivative of Dasha, means to anoint, symbolic of the Masayah. But the primary meaning of Dasha is actually to grow. So Dashel would be to grow with God. So the concept here is God says, I want life to grow. So the whole concept of his covenant is that the renewed life that he conceives in his covenant family grows. God wants us to become more than we would otherwise be without him. So when we are immersed in the set-apart spirit, we grow. We dasha, or dashel, we grow with God. The language of salvation, therefore, continues to permeate every word of this revelation. From living and being born anew, the seed here is also interesting, because as God will develop the story of the covenant in upcoming chapters of this same book of Bereshith, he will constantly tell us that the seed of the covenant, the offspring of the covenant, the renewal and growth that comes from the covenant, and then he will ascribe benefits to those. There are five specific benefits that the seed of the covenant enjoy, and here he used this concept of seed, zera, twice in this short statement, recognizing that the seed of the covenant is our growth. We become enriched. We become empowered. In addition to that, the seed of the covenant is that we live forever, very similar to this particular statement. One of the benefits of the covenant, of course, is that we become perfect, existing upright and established. Ken would be particularly in conjunction with Haya, which means Haya is to exist, and Ken means upright, established, that we as beneficiaries of the covenant become upright and established, perfect in God's eyes. We also, as members of the covenant family, are adopted into God's family and given admission into his home, and so we flourish in that environment, which would be very similar to the concept of Dasha, particularly Dasha El, and we have El, God, in this statement as well. So when we become his children, we grow with him. All of this then reflects the concepts that are associated with the covenant. It is also instructive to note that etz, which was translated here as trees, is often rendered wood or timber, especially when depicting an upright pole or stake. And in this particular case, he's talking not only about the upright pillars that form the doorway to life that became an essential aspect of the first Passover, but also of the upright one who hung on the upright pillar of Passover, allowing Passover to become the doorway to God's home and to life. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the second half of the third day of creation from Yahweh's perspective. Day three is a spiritual story of Bukurim, of first fruits, the third Mikra, and the third day coalesce in this regard. The third day is all about the Mikra of Bukurim. That's what it is called. Bukurim means first fruits, and God here in this presentation spoke of the of this being a day of first fruits. It is interesting also that the second of God's seven Moed Mikre is unleavened bread. It's about removing yeast from us. It's cleansing us of yeast. And, of course, that second day was totally focused upon water, which is the solvent that God constantly references symbolically as being the source of our cleansing. So, and even the very life and existence of the universe, the universe came to exist from the eternal one, with Haya being repeated so many times in that first epic, that the first Moed Mikre is Passover, whose sole purpose is to make us immortal. So God is literally following the pattern of his Moed Mikre here with Passover, the doorway to continued existence, life eternal, with unleavened bread, matzah, cleansing us so that we appear perfect in God's eyes, and of Bukurim, which is the third of the seven Moed Mikre, with Bukurim being referenced here by first fruits on this particular day. Bukurim is based upon the word bakar, which is firstborn children. So it speaks of the children that are born unto the covenant family. But this is also the story of parentage. If we want to live forever, we have to be born into Yahweh's family. And that is why day three is presented in two parts. Life flows from the living waters of Yahweh's maternal spirit. Scientifically speaking, the word create was not used on this day. With a little direction, the system Yahweh had composed previously on day one facilitated what happened naturally. The bottom line is that creation is the product of inputting the precise amount of energy required for the desired result, and that it is based upon the most complex multivariable equation ever conceived. So the creative event took place on the first day. Now, there will be another creative event, but you should recognize that up to this point there has been one creative event, and that with God's guidance, everything else that he has described evolved from that creative event. And that was the calculation of precisely how much energy to put into the system, and the transformation with his orchestration of energy into matter and the formation of the universe. Now, based upon what we have learned from relativity and the natural spiral measurement standards described in Scripture, cosmologically, the third day of Yahweh's testimony begins when the fossil evidence dictates, 3.8 billion years ago, the time fossil finds from around the world attest that life began. This cosmic epoch ended around 1.9 billion years before our era, with our atmosphere benefiting from plants, which were converting poisonous, at least to us, carbon dioxide into breathable oxygen. It's a marvelous system where the plants take that which is poisonous to us, carbon dioxide, and they consume it in a way that is nurturing to them, and their byproduct is breathable oxygen, which is required by us. And then we breathe in, all animals do, oxygen, and we convert it into carbon dioxide, which is beneficial for the plants. It is a marvelous symbiotic relationship, one that was conceived to perform exactly as we have just discussed. Consistent with Yahweh's testimony, the instant that the smoke dissipated and the earth cooled, allowing liquid water to appear, the simplest organic life forms sprouted forth in great abundance, and they reproduced after their kind, making the earth green. Also, Barghorn was the first paleontologist to discover bacteria and algae fossils dating in rocks, which could be shown to have developed 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago. So we now know for certain that the first bacteria and algae, these would be plant fossils, in rocks date back to between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years ago. This was coterminous with the time that liquid water first appeared and gathered in seas and lakes. The greenstone belt of southwestern Greenland confirms that the surface temperatures of our planet first fell below the boiling point of water, 100 degrees Celsius, 3.8 times 10 to the 9th years ago. And that the lower layer of sedimentary rocks in this region contain organic materials, evidencing the emergence of life at precisely this time. Sediments of the Warona in the northwestern Australia, dating to 3.7 times 10 to the 9th years ago, record a shallow marine environment consisting of fossils of filamentous cyanobacterium, which are prokaryotes, similar to modern Nostoc. The prokaryote microfossils of Echobacterium are also found in Swaziland's Frigti formation, which dates back to this period as well. So we have three regions of the world, all of which date back to the time period of 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago, where organic plant life emerged, all at the same time, and all within a cosmic nanosecond of the seas not only gathering together, but of the temperature of the water in them falling below the boiling point. You know, you can freeze water, and you do not necessarily kill the organic material in the water. But if you boil water, you almost always kill the organic material. So it was not possible to conceive life and to have life replicate in waters above the boiling point, not at least in a meaningful way. But once the water's cooled, instantly, life existed, and as far away as Greenland, you know, and up there skirting the Arctic Circle, and in Australia, at the bottom half of our globe, and then as far away as Africa, all at the same time. This also tells you that the notion that plant life began in a spontaneous way in one place strictly by chance, and then figured out a way to replicate itself, and then evolve from that point, isn't true. That we now find that life just came to exist, and it came to exist everywhere. And the evidence of that life is found in these parched and dry lands. Now, as a result of these findings, biological scientists now recognize that the first life forms on Earth did not emerge following 2 to 3 billion years of random chance, as previously thought, as Darwin's evolutionary model requires. Now, this discovery was sufficient to completely discard macroevolutionary theory. The moment that we came to realize that within a cosmic nanosecond of the time that liquid water gathered on the planet and that it fell below the boiling point, that all over the globe, animal life appeared. The touted theory of Darwin evolutionary models cratered. They require that life would only have by chance been conceived once. Mathematically, it is impossible that it could have happened once. But that they say that with enormous eons of time, the impossible becomes possible. And yet, rather than there being the 2 to 3 billion years, the eons of time, it happened instantaneously and everywhere. Completely destroying. The facts completely destroy the evolutionary model promoted by Darwinists. But what do arrogant scientists do? Oh, no. Don't look at those facts over there. We've got other facts we want you to consider. Life came to exist concurrently with the appearance of liquid water. These facts disprove microevolution. Yet most scientists are unwilling to admit it or to take the next logical step. Harvard University biology professor and Nobel laureate George Wald is one of those still living in the past and desperately clinging to creation rather than the creator. He wrote these words, which were published in and later refuted by Scientific American. Quote, however improbable we regard the start of all life, or any of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen, at least once. And for life as we know it, once may be enough. Life is, in fact, the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, and the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. The singular basis of his assertion, actually his statement of faith, ladies and gentlemen, is false, rendering his conclusion false. And we will reconsider this statement when Shattering Mist returns in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yetta. We are considering what I think is perhaps amongst the most revealing statements ever made by a scientist. This is Harvard University biology professor and Nobel laureate George Wald. His statements regarding evolution show the faith that scientists have put into this theory that, in their view, replaces God, and how it is completely and totally inaccurate, invalid. You see, scientists actually recognize that the chance of accidental, of random chance creation of life, and that life being able to instantly nourish itself, feed, and then that life being able to reproduce, and that life being able to protect its fragile nature, all at one instant, is far less likely than a tornado going over a junkyard of used cars, and the result being a flyable 747. It's infinitely less likely than that. Even if there were billions of billions upon billions, even trillions of years, it doesn't change the fact that it is so improbable as to be impossible. But beyond that, here's someone acknowledging, yeah, okay, so the math doesn't work out. So when you take in all the factors, it really isn't possible. But we have 2 billion years of time, and at that much time, somehow time changes the equation and makes the impossible not only possible, but probable. And then virtually certain. And he's even of the point that, you know, if life was conceived once, that is enough, because he realizes it's so impossible that it could not have happened more than once. And yet here now we find absolute proof that rather than being 2 billion years, there wasn't even 5 million years. And rather than being a life in one place, it was conceived everywhere instantly. Absolutely refuting the scientific theory. Macroevolution has been wholly and totally destroyed by the evidence. I'll read the Scientific American statement by George Wald, Harvard biology professor and Nobel laureate again, because even Scientific American, after these findings that I have just shared with you, retracted the statement. However improbable we regard the start of all life, or any of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once, and for life as we know it, once may be enough. Time is, in fact, the hero of our plot. The time with which we have to deal is of the order of 2 billion years. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs the miracles. This concept of time makes the improbable certain position was promulgated for decades by leading biologists and is still taught today. But it is absolutely and unequivocally untrue. Scientific American admitted as much in a special publication called Life, Origin and Evolution. It was their first and only retraction of a Nobel laureate's writings. Quote, although stimulating, this article probably represents one of the very few times in his professional life when Wald has been wrong. Examine his main thesis and see. Can time form a biological cell by waiting for chance combination of organic compounds? Harold Morowitz, in his book Energy Flow and Biology, computed that merely to create a bacterium would require more time than the universe might ever see if chance combinations of its molecules were the only driving force. End quote. More time than the universe might ever see. They calculate that it is 14 billion years old, and that it isn't even at the halfway point, not according to their calculations. And yet it would never happen. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back in a moment.
Hi, everyone. I'm Pharmacist Ben, nutritional pharmacist and host of The Bright Side. The good news about nutrition and health. The good news that if you or someone you care about is on a prescription drug or has some...